in front of an opening visible in the darkness only as a greater gash of black. Her nostrils flare as she sniffs the cold air pulling at the cave mouth. And as an image of Palor materializes in my vision, I understand. It's an entrance to the dragon nests. The underground network of cave tunnels below the palace is expansive and labyrinthine, and its lowest levels are said to connect with the city drainage system. Years making my way down to the Aurelian cave corridor and Ayla's nest only exposed me to a fraction of the tunnel system. I knew there were other entrances, but until now, I'd never seen one. Close by, the River Fir roars at the base of the Cedar Grove and Paran's spring. The entrance to the nests yawns before us. Ayla strains, sniffing, and her hackles rise. Her alarm spills into me. Palor's scent is there, but it mingles with other dragons she doesn't know. Unfamiliar dragons in our caves. Ours are there too, frightened. The tunnel reeks of fear even from here. But so far, still in one piece. Including Palor. She launches into the yawning mouth with a growl, and before I can so much as hiss at her to heal, her snout butts against something hard and cold. An iron grate bars the passage, each bar as thick as my wrist. When she starts to summon flame, I stop her. If we break in now, we give away our position. There has to be a plan. She swings her head round to glare at me in the dark, as if to say, then make one. A mirage of Palor, silver and slender and alluring, clouds my vision again. I swat at the back of my neck, pushing Ayla's thoughts out. Alluring? Ugh. Keep those thoughts to yourself. He's in there, safe for now. But for how long? I need answers. Answers I can't get as a dragon rider. Lie low during the day, I tell Ayla. If you hunt, go at night. Ayla leans forward, her snout in my face, and huffs hot air. This seems to signal approval, because she begins winding in obliging circles, smoking the needle-covered earth into a makeshift nest. Her wings fold to her sides as she settles, and her tail curls round them. I shoulder my saddlebag, rub Ayla's chin beneath her already closing eyes, and make my way on foot to the bank of the Fir, my dragon-riding boots slurping in the hard-packed mud. The Island of the Dead looms in the middle of the river, its ancient dragonborn tombs rising in black silhouettes that were cracked and ruined by the revolution. The water roars louder than my thoughts as I trace the bank downstream around the base of Pytho's Keep. The arena rises over me first, then the outer walls of the palace, and finally, Highmarket Bridge. Vagrants gather by a barrel fire under the stone pillars. Before leaving the bank behind, I step into shadow and rummage in my saddlebag. The dress I have is Aga's. My throat tight, I pull it once more over my flame suit and wrap her scarf around my hair. Then I climb up the narrow utility stairs into the river walk and cross the bridge into Highmarket. My first stop is based on a single remembered conversation. Annie, I need to talk to you. Something's going on. She's not the help I would have wanted. She's not even someone I like. In our longest conversation, I threatened her family with dragonfire, and days later she splashed the story of that exchange on the front page of the People's Paper. But whatever reform she wanted, I'm pretty sure this wasn't it. And I think she was trying to tell me about it the last time we spoke, when I shrugged her off. thanks to the file I reviewed before interrogating her in the vault. I know exactly where to find Megara Roper. My tired feet carry me across the People's Square, down the Triumphal Way, and into Southside, to the inn known as Misanthrope. The bar on the ground floor is open despite the late hour. Val Lazar, Megara's uncle and leader of the Passy, lounges against the counter and glances my way without interest when I enter. "Wipe those boots," he calls. I kick river mud from my boots and ask a serving boy stoking the fire for directions. "Megara?" he asks in surprise. "That's my sister. What do you want with her?" So this must be Lex. I last encountered his name on a list of relatives I threatened Megara with. I'm one of her friends from the Lyceum. Lex's face sours, as if the elite school his sister attends is not something he likes hearing mention of. He directs me up uneven stairs to the second floor of the inn, points to a door with peeling paint at the far end of the hall, and hurries back downstairs. A middle-aged woman with wispy, peppered hair answers my knock, smiling at me with vacant and slightly crossed eyes.
"You're not Val," she says.
"Mum, I told you I'd..." Megara Roper appears beside her mother. She freezes at the sight of me. Her black hair, shorn during her arrest at the vault, spikes around her face, her bright green eyes matched by the scarf wound tight around her neck.
"You've got to be kidding."
"I'm sorry. I didn't know where else to..." Megara looks down the deserted hallway with wide eyes, then reaches for my arm and yanks.
"Get inside!"
Megara drags me to her table, stuffs me on a stool and serves me soup, all the while glaring at me. The cluttered room is lit by a single oil lamp and smells of musty bedclothes. Her mother, Katerina, remains aloof by the door. Megara gives me a pewter spoon, but I'm in no state to use it. I slurp the soup directly from the bowl. I can feel its warmth pooling in my empty stomach.
"You've got a lot of nerve."
Megara stands opposite me, as if unwilling to commit to conversation by taking the stool opposite. I lower the nearly empty bowl and wipe my mouth.
"I've got nowhere else to go. There's been some sort of coup."
"You mean a change of government by order of the reinstated People's Assembly?"
I feel my heart sinking to my toes. "So it was a legitimate transfer of power?" Megara lifts a shoulder.
"As legitimate as it can be, with a Goliath circling overhead while you take the vote. Though honestly, most people seem more excited by the spectacle than frightened by it."
"Why would they be excited by a Goliath circling over their heads?" Megara hesitates. Her face puckers, like she's on the verge of laughing, or maybe crying.
"Some princess was throwing bread from its back.
And that was all it took." Megara seems not to notice herself sinking into the stool. She stares down at her own hands unseeing, as if the horror of the memory has momentarily taken her somewhere else. For the first time in my life, I think I might just be sharing an emotion with Megara Roper. After centuries of dragonborn oppression, after only 10 years' freedom from it, the people chose dragon lords. All it took was a bit of a performance and some loaves of bread. And even though I know this assembly would have been filled by the urban poor, who suffered less under the dragon lords and were most affected by Atreus's rationing program, the ease of the revolution's fall is still a testament to the ways the regime I served failed its people. By the door, Megara's mother lets out an unexpected staccato laugh, still staring at shadows.
Ignore her, Megara mutters, her mouth twisting. Katerina was arrested for protesting the new regime's dissolution of its first democratic assembly years ago. She emerged from prison unrecognizable. I know this from my interrogation of Megara during her own stint in the vault. Failure, failure, failure. My failures blur with Atreus's. His regime ruined Katerina, and then I threatened to use dragonfire on Megara in that regime's name. Innocent victims, mistakes that litter this city and leave it open to the first voice raised to offer an alternative. Ixion Stormscourge, come to rebuild his dynasty in the rubble. I look at the dregs of the soup and find I no longer have any appetite. Tyndale was in on it, wasn't he? And Lothiran, your passy friends. That's what you were trying to tell me the other day. Megara nods. They call them clovers, after the Triarchy's sigil of exile. I didn't realize until the plan was already in motion. My uncle had no idea either. And now you're going along with it. Megara grimaces. She runs a finger along a grain of wood. Her table, I realize, isn't a table at all, but a door spread across two barrels. Tyndale says they'll let the people's paper print freely. The Basileian grain shipments will feed our hungry. My uncle's been invited to represent the lower bank at the first Privy Council, and the rumour is they'll allow the assembly to stand. So, I've got what I wanted, haven't I? You sound uncertain. Megara lifts a palm, and fingers clench and unclench in her shorn hair as she thinks through it. The Lyceum's closed, she says. They're saying it's temporary. But there's talk of reopening it with different admission standards, now that the metals test has been eliminated. She pauses, leaving me to imagine with perfect ease the kind of admission standards Ixion and his ilk might put in place. Whatever, she adds bitterly. It was only ever rich kids there anyway. But she and I, both students of the Lyceum, are evidence that wasn't true. The faults of Atreus's regime were gaping. Katerina stands evidence of that. But the Lyceum he established let in, albeit grudgingly and rarely, commoners and girls. A Triarchist restoration backed by patrician conspiracy and an occupying empire has every reason to discontinue such reforms. The one sputtering spigot of social advancement that Atreus's regime offered to its poor, its lowborn, its women, to lift themselves from the stations they were born to, will be cut off. The metals test unfairly favoured the privileged. But with Ixion at the helm, its elimination will be an excuse to rewind the clock 10 years. Then what will you... I'm already on Tyndale's staff at the People's Paper. I don't need to finish school. Megara's emotionless tone doesn't fool me for an instant. Going to try your hand at making change from within? I ask. It was the strategy she used to mock me for. She matches my sarcasm with a scowl. I assume you're here to start a counter-counter-coup? Assassinate the Dragonborn and every one of their clovers, put Atreus back in office? All it would take is a little massacre. I shake my head. No point. We're occupied. I saw the Basileian reinforcements on their way here. I can't fight an empire. Not with one dragon. Not even with every guardian. Against a dragon the size of Freyda's. Perhaps we could make a valiant last stand. But I'm not interested in that. Callipolis has had enough bloodshed. What I can help are my friends. Locked away in the palace, for all I know, already suffering torture and death. Kallipolis has fallen, but the guardians remain my responsibility. I set the bowl I've drained on Megara's stained and crumb-strewn table. Have you had any sight of Kor or Lee since the Triarchy was reinstated? Megara shakes her head. But Lee seemed chummy enough with his cousin at the assembly. I feel a prickling along my neck at this idea, which I suppress. The idea of Lee being friendly with his family feels like a recurring nightmare. It's fear well forgotten. I remind myself that whatever Megara thought she saw at the assembly, I know Lee, and I know Ixion. I know their history. The chumminess you thought you saw was a ruse. Lee killed Ixion's sister. And if you haven't seen Kor, he's under arrest. I know she considers Lee a close friend. And Kor, whom she's known since grade school, more than that. Megara's fingers drum against her folded arms. She has paled. What do you need? Get me into the palace. I'll do the rest.
11. The Privy Council. Lee. The morning of the second day of the Clover Restoration, I attend Ixion Stormscourge's first Privy Council as Protector of Kallipolis in Atreus's stead. I rinse my hands of his blood in the washroom on the way. Civil servants dangle by their necks in the courtyards I pass through. They were all high-ranking officials, all gold, most low-born. One of them, a straw-haired young Highlander named Declan, once danced with Annie at a feast. His face is blotched and bloated in the dawn light. Either he failed a loyalty test, or finishing him was a loyalty test someone else passed. The message is clear enough. The restoration has no need for low-born blights who rose so high. My empty stomach churns as I make my way into the council room. Ixion greets me on the threshold. Cousin, I'm glad you could make it. How was your visit with the Protector? Edifying. I thought it might be. Ixion opens his arm to the woman standing at his side, a veil folded back over her long hair. May I present Her Divine Highness, Freda Basileon? The court etiquette I'd been taught by the time of the revolution was not extensive, and much of it I've since forgotten. When I straighten from the full courtesy bow I guess is due, the Basileian princess's smile seems more amused than anything. The young woman who has come to make Kallipolis a vassal state does not have particularly commanding features, a heart-shaped face, warm brown hair pulled into a long braid, and smiling eyes. But she moves with the poise of someone used to being obeyed. It's impossible to forget that she brings a Goliathan and an empire with her smile. Leo Surpelor, she says in guttural dragon tongue, the one about whom we've heard so much. Your Divine Highness. The Basileian honorific, at stark contrast with the Kallipolan tradition of gods long dead, chafes on its way out. Freda's lips remain curved. Ixion takes Atreus's habitual seat at the head of the table, Freda to his right, and gestures for me to take the seat to his left. The room has been minimally modified, with the sigil of the restoration, three circling dragons containing the black clover, replacing the revolutionary dragon on the high wall. A single great storm scourge with a silver-tipped crest lounges outside on the firemouth balcony. Ixion's storm scourge, Nita. My wrist is still lacking a wristband or summoner. Palor still cut off from me. Ixion's freshly composed privy council begins to file in. Some are clearly long-standing members of the Order of the Black Clover, like Richard Tyndale and Lucian Orthos. I'm more surprised when we're joined by those who look less eager. General Holmes glances at the altered wall hangings in consternation before taking a seat. Miranda Hayne, the Minister of Propaganda, sports a bruise on the side of her brown face and hides trembling hands in her lap. Dora Mithridates, one of the chief constituents of the Janiculum, offers Ixion a creaking curtsy, though her lips remain pursed. Val Lazar, the leader of the Passy and Megara Roper's uncle, sinks heavily into a seat beside Dora, who eyes him with distaste and scoots sideways. Were they threatened, I wonder, or bribed? Or did they only touch a finger to the changing winds and adjust course? Do they hope, as I do, that some good can still be wrought from within? Power Sur Ita comes in last of all, laughing loudly at something Edmund Greyheather just said. He catches sight of me and cocks a brow. Unlike me, he has been permitted his summoner. When all are gathered, Ixion speaks. The first protector has taken ill. In his absence, Leo and I will provide guidance. Leo as your interim protector, and I as your new first rider. Holmes's reaction is automatic and incredulous. You are not our... But then he remembers himself and blanches. Too late. Ixion's smile is curdling. Remind me again what class metal was your son's test result going to be? Iron? Or was it at least bronze? Lucien told me you were quite surprised with that news yesterday. When Holmes doesn't answer, Ixion's fingers lace themselves and flatten on the table. But yes, you have introduced our first item on the agenda, the so-called first rider of the Kallipolan fleet, Antigone Farhall's serf, who seems to have fled in the night. Ixion uses the feudal designation just as he did with Rock. Except now, the Drakarki named is not his father's but mine. Antigone's pre-revolutionary status, belonging to us like the land she was born on. Antigone Sur Ayla. The Draconym feels like a ward against evil. Her name is Antigone Sur Ayla.
We had an encounter, Edmund Greyheather says. Parsival even got talons in her, over the Ferrish Plain.
Outside, Nita's tail swishes and the glass rattles. Ixion says, and you let her go? Power shrugs, though his gaze flicks to Nita's swishing tail. She tore free, but she can't have gone far. We'll find her. So Annie's come back from New Pythos, which leaves the question, what did she leave behind? And when will Ixion find out?
See that you do. I would like to put an end to any confusion about my title.
The other outstanding question is about the whereabouts of Crissa Surfidra, whom Ixion refers to as Crissa Ward. By now, the patterns of his nomenclature are clear. Patrician riders alone retain the draconyms we took when we became guardians. Commoners, like Crissa and Kor, are referred to by their family names, and Annie and Rock by less than that.
Titus is on it, Edmund says. Lucien informed us Ward was on a diplomatic trip to Deimos and should be on her way back shortly.
Ixion moves on to the needs of his constituents next, represented by Val Lazar for the lower bank and Dora for the upper. For the lower bank, Ixion is willing to leave the People's Paper autonomous within reason, and more than willing to approve the suspension of the metals laws as the People's Assembly decided in its referendum. At this allowance, Miranda Hayne stirs.
Miranda?
Ixion invites warmly. From my angle, the bruise blooming down the side of Hayne's cheek is clearly visible. Her voice is reed thin.
There have been questions about plans to reopen the Lyceum and criteria for admission now that the metals test has been retired.
Ixion smiles. Well, we have a good deal of debt to pay off to our generous benefactors, he says with a nod to Freda Basileon.
I was thinking education might be an immediate source of revenue. State expenditures in that department have been wildly bloated by Athanatos's public scholarship funds, an unnecessary luxury in these trying times. Let the Lyceum be open to all. All who can pay for it.
Miranda's swallow is loud. Lazar's eyes have narrowed. It escapes no one that those who can pay for it will be almost exclusively of patrician birth. At the least, from families of already minted elites. Power is the one who speaks first. Clever, my lord. He hasn't looked so viciously amused since the day Atreus introduced a stratified rationing program. Thank you, Parsival. That brings us to the Janiculum. The Janiculum is the neighborhood on the upper bank at the foot of Pytho's Keep, where most patrician families keep their manors. Many of the wealthiest, like Dora, retained their status after the revolution by being helpful to Atreus during it. Dora Mithridates caught off guard, pulling at the neck of her sweater as if it circles too tightly around her throat, lifts her chin, and returns Ixion's stare.
I think you will find the Janiculum cooperative, sire.
Oh, good. Because while the palace is being restored to its original grandeur, the Dragonborn will require quartering. I was hoping your manor, and others, might be available for our use.
Dora's eyes widen.
It would be my pleasure, my lord.
My family would be honoured to host as well, Power says. My foster family, I mean. Hesperides House. My wife would love to have you, my lord, Lothirin adds.
Ixion smiles.
Perhaps we should spread the word, he says, and see which noble patrician houses are most eager. The most eager should be willing to provide names of those who are less so. Particular favour will be given to those who can name Palace Day perpetrators, for whom justice remains to be served.
Dora's chin wobbles slightly as she inclines it. The international situation is reviewed next. Freyda reports that her grain shipments are on their way, on schedule, via canals that connect the port at Fort Arran with the fur. Basileian warships will bring with them her household and her personal army, a division of the Imperial Guard dedicated to the Princess Heir and known as the Little Immortals. When Ixion compliments her willingness to buck the custom of servants preparing the way for the lady, she says,
You will find I am full of surprises.
Ixion laughs, charmed. Freyda smiles back. General Holmes's brows are level with his hairline. So I'm not the only one thinking Ixion is an idiot.
And the dragon? Holmes asks.
No one has to ask which dragon. Freyda says,
Obizuth has been nesting atop Pytho's Keep. She likes a high perch.
Not to mention a vantage point out of range of our cannons, from which a Goliathan could set the greater part of the city on fire with a single long breath. Holmes folds his arms and expels air.
Darshi!
Two Skyfish Grey Riders have been sent as messengers to New Pythos, informing the Dragonborn waiting there that the way has been prepared for the long-awaited return.
And the plucky Norsian Humble Riders? Freyda asks.
This comment seems to touch a sore point. Ixion's smile has tightened.
As discussed, they have been disposed of.
Unless Annie has a big surprise for you. Freyda only seems more amused.
Very good, my lord, she says.
What about my riders? I ask.
Ixion looks at me for the first time.
You mean my riders?
Hayne has actually braced her palms against the edge of the table as if to push herself out of the way of our crossfire. I can hear Atreus's voice in my ears, challenging and cool.
It's time to discuss what you'll do when you leave this room.
I mean the Guardians. I think, between the Goliathan and the Dragonborn, we don't really have need for more riders, do we?
In its way, this veiled threat is the news I'm looking for. It means Ixion's reserving the Guardians for leverage. Means they are still alive, means that somewhere down in some dungeon, they're awaiting his verdict. Outside, Nita's wings ruffle and the glass creaks. My wrist itches for its wristband, for Palor. I force myself to look not at the Storm Scourge, but at Ixion. The Guardians are celebrities in Kallipolis. Children know them by name on the street. They will not be so easily forgotten, and if you want our restoration to be a success, we will need them. I'm prepared to keep the Patrician Guardians. We can discard the rest. Discard. As if he were clearing a pantry of spoiled goods. Patricians make up perhaps a third of the Revolutionary Fleet. Their families are reputed to have diluted dragonborn blood from occasional intermarrying with the three families. It's a point of pride that I've heard Dora mention before. Works for me, says Power. I've seen Power snarl that his mother was a cheapsider, but no such outburst seems forthcoming today. Which is hardly surprising, because if one thing can always be relied upon, it's that Power can't be. My fingers are curling on my knees. Some of our most popular riders are lowborn. Not to mention highest ranked, Cor Sur Morana, Richard Sur Bast, and Chrissa Sur Phaedra, and Antigone Sur Aela. Except the last thing I want to do is remind him of them now. But that's the thing, Ixion says. That seems like it could be confusing to the people. Much like Antigone Farhall Surf, at large, a rival claimant to the title of First Rider, these suspiciously high-ranked riders of low birth make it look as though any commoner can fly as well as a dragonborn, which, we all know, is not true. There is a moment where Ixion waits to see if anyone will contradict him, and everyone else makes a point not to meet anyone's eyes. Freyda is smirking, though it's unclear at what. You see the difficulty, Ixion goes on, once he's satisfied with our silence. There cannot be two First Riders, two Alterni, two Tertii, and so on. It would be terribly confusing for everybody. My heart is hammering in my ears. Then let them prove themselves. Ixion cocks his head. You've got two claimants for Quartai, let them face off. Set Cor Sutter against Edmund Greyheather in the arena. Edmund lets out a single barking laugh as though I've made a joke. To my surprise and immediate foreboding, Ixion smiles too. You know, cousin, he says, I rather like that idea.
12. The Interview. Annie. When I wake, I find the soreness left over from the work in Norcia, and the flight afterward has stiffened my limbs like concrete. It takes a moment to remember that it isn't a nightmare I've woken from, but to. I'm home, and home is flying the yellow banners of Basilia. My friends are locked inside a palace now controlled by Ixion, and I'm sleeping on a pile of sour-smelling laundry in the apartment of a girl who was, until recently, probably my least favourite person in Kallipolis. When she shakes me, roaches scatter. What time is it? Past noon. You looked like you needed the sleep. Megara sets a bottle of vinegar beside a pot of steaming black tea her mother, Katerina, is stirring. Their makeshift table is one of the few excuses for furniture in the room. Most of the Roper family's possessions, laundry and kitchenware, are stacked in piles directly on the floor. Her brother Lex snores from another pile of clothes. I have the groggy thought that for all the time Megara and I spent circling each other, resentful of the other's supposed privilege, her family's home is almost as humble as mine was, and more neglected. You're in luck, Megara says, and hands me the proof of an article slated to run in the afternoon edition of the People's Paper. Ixion Sur Nita, First Rider of Kallipolis, challenges Antigone Farhall Surf to prove herself in the arena.
Farhol Surf. Megara nods. The style guides have been updated. That was fast. I skim the rest of the article. Each ranked position in the fleet will be competed for publicly by any guardian who wishes to challenge a dragonborn for the slot in what is being called a winnowing. The dates of the competitions will soon be announced. Anyone who knows the whereabouts of Antigone Farhol Surf should come forward for a reward. Well? Well, what? I ask, passing the paper back to her. Well, shouldn't you face him? And accomplish what? Megara stares at me. She slaps the paper on the floor where we're sitting, and a roach crunches. You think it's a trap? I nearly laugh. Obviously it's a trap. Not the problem. You might want to ask after that reward, though. Megara rolls her eyes. If you don't show, people will say you ran, that you're a coward. People say a lot of things about me already. Her lips tighten. The things they say about me, that I'm a heartless and cruel leader, that I slept my way to the top of the core leveraging Lee's affection, are narratives she helped create in the People's Paper during the bunker riots. After Bitch Commander and Dragon Lord's Whore, why not add Coward to the list? I know, she says slowly, that Ixion might be a challenge for you. I could wipe the floor with him. I say this with such surety that Megara's chin goes back. But why demur? Ayla and I have met Ixion Sionita in the air before. We know our abilities against his. That wouldn't help my friends get out of prison or to safety, and that's what I'm here to do. Your first rider, Megara says. Don't you have any desire to defend the title? Why won't she drop it? It's not my mission. Megara puffs air from her cheeks. Fine, she says. Then we do Plan B. Plan B is the tea and vinegar. The palace, undergoing renovations for the restoration, while the Dragonborn Quarter in Estates of the Janiculum, is on a hiring spree as part of a new loyalty initiative. Megara intends to dye my hair so I can interview disguised. Word from the Clovers is the transition team's taken special interest in getting some Highlanders on the staff, Megara says. Can you still do the brogue? I don't know. But it's easy, lass. Please stop. Half a bottle of vinegar and a cup of black tea later, I stare at my reflection in a dirty tin mirror, and a dark-haired young woman stares back at me. Dressed in Aga's patched dress, I look more like a peasant woman from my home village than the guardian whose flame suit I've folded in a corner. I'm vaguely unsettled by the sight. Now that Megara's dropped it, the goad lingers. Your first rider. Don't you have any desire to defend the title? I think of the moment Roxana told me I'd won a battle and lost a war, that while helping Griff, my own city had fallen. The snapping point after weeks and months spent bending to serve a city that painted insults about my incompetence on its walls. In the end, the insults were right. I can wipe the floor with Ixion, but that doesn't make me deserving of a title as Kallipolis's defender. Not anymore. Defeating him wouldn't change that a Goliathan perches on Pytho's keep, or that our streets swarm with Basileian soldiers. If the uncomfortable truth is that I feel safer rescuing my friends wearing a peasant's dress than my flame suit, that doesn't mean it's not the best way to get the job done. It's blisteringly cold, sunlight glaring from a dry blue sky, when I leave the Roper apartment for the first time. Mrs. Roper's thin brown mantle is wound tight around Aga's dress for warmth, and my guardian wristband, with its summoner for Ayla, is tucked inside my brassiere on the same chain as my mother's pendant. It seems like a lifetime since Lee gave it to me. As I trudge through the city, I take in the changes since I last walked these streets. The yellow whale fin of Basilia emblazoned on the breasts of the soldiers overseeing ration distribution. The triarchal banner of the Restoration fluttering on the palace walls. And unfamiliar dragon riders silhouetted overhead. The only dragon I recognize is Eta. Ayla has sensed no violence from the lairs, only fear. I know instinctively, through our connection resting dormant at this distance, that I would feel if she had cause for greater alarm. They're all in there. I just have to get to them. On the way, I leave a letter from Duck to his family on their back step, informing them he's alive. After crossing Highmarket Bridge, I follow the slow trickle of citizens making their way through security at a side gate of the outer palace. The job applicants let in by the guard gawp at the grand courtyards with open mouths. 9 years ago, I gawped too. A porter directs me to the interview queue at a side hall, and as I recognize it, I suppress a horrible laugh. It's the hall where students made eligible by the metals test once had our choosing ceremony. This is where Ayla chose me, and I became a guardian. No dragons wait for me inside today. Instead, three chairs are clumped in the otherwise deserted room, and a plump, middle-aged woman with a round pink face invites me to sit in calash accented with basilic. Beside her sits our old drill master, Wes Gorin. A clover adorns his lapels. It's all I can do to keep myself from stopping dead. Last I heard, he was dismissed from Atreus's administration for his bigotry towards those of birth like mine. It looks like he has found an employer more tolerant of it. And now my short ruse is up. For a frozen moment, as I look at my drillmaster, I consider running. But then his glance flicks from the clipboard to my face, and he doesn't so much as blink.
"Abigail Nearhallsurf?" he asks, sounding bored.
The hall's not particularly well lit. My tea-stained hair and commoner garb little resemble the commander he should recognize. But more than that, I suspect Wes Gorin does not know me because, for most of my life, I was an abomination he avoided letting his eyes linger on. And now, it seems a bit of black tea in my hair is enough for him not to see me at all. I nod shakily.
"Please, sit,"
the pink-faced woman says warmly, in her rippling basilic accent, and I do.
"I'm Betsuna, mistress of Freda's household. This is Wes Gorin, high steward of the Clover Restoration."
I compose my expression into something that I hope approximates awed intimidation.
"You're from the Highlands?"
Betsuna asks, checking her roster. The brogue that used to be mine had to be regained with practice, in a mirror alongside Megara. At least mine, unlike Megara's, sounds natural.
"Yes, m'lady." "How did you come to be in the capital?"
"Looking for work, m'lady. The usurper's rationing ran our village dry." Gorin's vaguely bored gaze fixes on my face for a breath longer than I'd like it to.
"You Highlanders really do look alike," he comments. Inbreeding. He grunts to Betsuna in dragon tongue. You think your royalty is bad? She lifts her hand to cup a startled, tinkling laugh. I keep my expression slack and still, the way I learned to when this man was my drillmaster and insulted me to my face. Do I resemble someone you know, my lord? I ask in Kalish. Goran grunts and does not correct the title he isn't owed. But that Highlander did not know her place. Betsuna glances between us, surprised by the challenge in his tone. I incline my head, feeling a flush creep up my neck. Then I take a breath and make the speech that I drafted in Megara's living room and practiced with her until the words made my face burn. No one would say this, she told me at the time. My father would have said it. Was your father a groveling dog? I looked up at her. When he needed to be? Now I think of my father. I keep my feelings inside. And I say what Wes Goran wants to hear. They want loyalty? I'll give them loyalty. Your servant knows who is her lord. Her family thanks the long-dead gods that Lord Ixion has ousted the usurper and regained his rightful seat. To serve in a dragonborn house would be the highest honor and the greatest privilege this humble one could hope for. I stare down at my lap and feel my own furious pulse. The skin of my exposed neck prickles, as if it senses Goran's gaze. For as long as I can remember, when Goran did trouble himself to look at me, I knew he saw a peasant girl who had forgotten her place. Now let him see one who has remembered it. He speaks to Betsuna in dragon tongue. She's easy on the eyes, at least. Back in Megara's flat, I sink shaking onto the stool, lower my face into my knees, and burst into panicked, sticky tears. I've been holding them in for the whole walk back. What happened? Megara asks, abandoning the proofs of a weekend edition, which are spread across their cluttered table. Were you recognized? I take the handkerchief she presses into my hand and clean my face. I'm breathing as hard as if I'd returned from the palace at a run. I got the job. Palace staff. Specific appointments will be made after the renovations are complete. That's good, isn't it? Megara asks, bewildered. She sinks to her knees beside me. Did someone hurt you? She's lowered her voice. I shake my head. No one hurt me. But I'd forgotten. Until that interview, what it was like to be so vulnerable. To be talked about as if you're not there. The child being held down and beaten. The surviving witness being forced to watch. And now to be a woman, whose attractiveness is commented on with candid disinterest by superiors. And I've got what I've wanted. Which is the chance to go back for more. My tears are drying, but Megara continues to stare at me. I grasp at an explanation. My old drillmaster interviewed me. He didn't recognize me. Well, that's good, Megara says. Tea stain did the trick.
13. The Princess's Suit. Lee. Dora Mithridates' manor is overrun by House Stormscourge. Dora herself evacuates to her coach house. Her servants are left to manage the bastards getting drunk from her liquor cabinet and their dragons overflowing in her gardens. Watching the gardener dart around the grounds, putting out small fires, makes me aware, as never before, of the reasons the palace was built from stone.
It's strange to imagine that one of these storm scourges, simmering perpetually with the rage of their breed, should have been mine. I still haven't been allowed to see Palor. To Ixion's consternation, Annie remains nowhere to be found. Her dragon hasn't been spotted again. Even his challenge in the People's Paper hasn't been enough to goad her into the light. "Your whore is a coward," he tells me at breakfast as we eat Dora's toast. I smile back at him. Denied my wings, and under what is pretty transparently house arrest, I have ample time to get to know my half-brother and the other Grey Riders while Ixion attends to business in the inner palace. The bastards breakfast late, with heavy helpings of champagne in their juice. Despite the efforts of a put-upon staff to contain it, their gatherings have the feeling of a student party. Many of the Grey Riders, like Edmund, are in their mid-twenties. "Hey, brother," says Edmund jovially from the settee where he sprawls in the sunroom. "Drink with us?" It's 10 in the morning. "I'm good, thanks." The glass doors to the balcony overlooking the gardens have been thrown open. A storm scourge, with nostrils smoking like twin cigars, lounges halfway into the breakfast room. Edmund tells me to take a seat beside him. It's somewhere between a jocular invitation and an order, and waves a hand carelessly toward the other two Grey Riders drinking with him, who have the characteristic storm scourge black hair, though theirs is curly. All the Grey Riders are male and unmarried. In the evening, the Janiculum has begun throwing dinner parties in their honour that swarm with eligible patrician daughters. "May I present Titus, Angelo, our cousins by not marriage, Ixion's hay brothers, the dragon, Zrath. We coordinated names around the vices." At the sound of his name, Wrath nickers sparks into the carpet. Titus and Edmund throw back their heads, laughing like baying dogs, as flames begin to curl round the edge of the carpet. Angelo, Titus's scrawny younger brother, scoots his chair out of the way with a curse.
"Oi, we talked about this. A little help here," Titus calls to the maids frozen in the act of clearing empty champagne flutes.
They scurry around the dragon and, absent footwear durable enough to stomp the flames, attempt to smother them with Dora's throw pillows, yelping as their fingers burn and their caps slip sideways. The boys watch, laughing, not bothering to get up. The parties of young dragon lords have always had a reputation, but this is the first time I get the sense of what they must have looked like. I seize the nearest pitcher of wine-spiked orange juice, overturn it, and watch the carpet fire hiss out. The maids stop hopping and yelping. The boys stop laughing, and Edmund scowls at me. "We were going to drink that." "You should douse your dragons if you let them in the house." Edmund rises. I set down the pitcher. My fists are curling, preparing for it to come to blows, eager for it, when a shout goes up in the central courtyard of Dora's manor. "I do believe that's your hay brother screaming," Edmund says to Titus and Angelo.
"Well," says Titus, stretching as he vaults to his feet, "you can't choose family."
We find Ixion in the center of the courtyard, tearing at his hair. The reason for his distress is a message borne by Skyfish Grey Riders who've just returned from New Pythos, or from as close to the former New Pythos as they could get. They could go no farther than the edge of Sailor's Folly, where Norsian dragon riders, led by Griff Garrison, formed a perimeter. There they found rowboats bearing the surviving dragonborn and the ashes of their dead. The survivors are on their way to Fort Arran. From there, they will be ferried to the capital by barge. Griff and the other riders, once squires but now styling themselves as the Woad Riders, sent Ixion's messengers home with word that New Pythos is now Norcia, and that while they want no quarrel with the restored Triarchy, they have taken hostages to ensure the peace. How was the uprising brought about? I hear a quick whisper of her name and feel a chill down my spine. These messengers forget to use the new styling. They tell us that Antigone Sur Aela came with Drakthanasia, she broke the muzzles, and the Haerelian Citadel burnt.
It's all I can do to keep my face still. She did it.
Ixion rages like a toddler in a tantrum, heedless of the audience of Dragonborn surrounding him in the courtyard, of Dora's servants pursing their lips. When he learns of the death of the ruling Haerelian family, and of his friends Rhode and Roxana, he tears his hair and screams. I'm relishing the sight, until I distinguish the words in his sobbing rage. I will butcher them! I will scorch them from the earth! Nita is roaring at his side, ash and sparks spewing from his mouth. You will not! Faemy Skyfish rode as a passenger with one of the messengers and has dismounted his skyfish. She stands in front of Ixion alone. Rather than the blue of her house, she wears the sackcloth of a sky widow. She smeared ash across her lids and her cheeks, and that ash has run with dried tears. Slender and tall, the brown skin of her head visible beneath clumps of roughly shorn hair, she looks like a walking ghost. Ixion on his knees goes silent as he looks up at her. You will not attack Norcia, she tells him, speaking in the meter of an old oath. You will leave my brother, who has sacrificed everything to protect me, in safety where he now lives as hostage. You will give the Norcians no cause to harm Astyanax Haerelian, last surviving heir of Rhadamanthus's house, or Electra Stormscourge, the great aunt who raised you. Those ungrateful animals deserve to be massacred, Faemy, Ixion says, his voice raw. Faemy goes to one knee in front of Ixion to meet his eyes. You will have mercy for the sake of my brother. You will hear this boon of me, freshly sky-widowed. Swear it on the death of your sister. Ixion wipes tears from his cheeks, drags wet fingers down hers, and she touches her hands to his, affirming the vow. I swear it. Then Ixion gets to his feet and turns to Power, who has landed with Eta at his right. Find her! The cold I feel is nothing compared with the expression on Power's face as he nods. But come evening, when Power returns yet again empty-handed, Ixion improvises. Two figures, hands bound, bags over their heads, are carted into Dora's courtyard and deposited onto their knees in front of Ixion. Angelo and Titus Greyheather restrain me on the opposite side of the yard. The bags are removed to reveal two guardians, Rock, sprawling, white-faced and gagged, and the Aurelian rider, Bryce. Bryce is a commoner from Southside, unskilled in the air despite the remedial drills I've run for him as long as I've been squadron leader. When they take off his gag, he begins pleading for his life in Kalish. Then he sees me and begins pleading to me. You want to know how we teach lessons in Norcia? Ixion asks me, and I know then that I am the nearest proxy for his rage, the closest he can get to Annie and Griff Garrison. The Norcians call it being put in the pen. He nods to Edmund, who summons his own hulking storm scourge. Envy. I'm straining so hard against the grey heathers, one of the Skyfish grey riders has to join in to hold me back. You said you'd let them prove themselves. I'll let some of them prove themselves, Lee. Others are perfectly expendable. They are innocent. But that seems to be the point. Faemy Skyfish and the Princess Freda Basileon watch from the far side of the courtyard, Faemy's expression a wall of stone, Freda's unreadable behind a veil. Envy alternates between fire and fang. He works over Bryce slowly with relish until Bryce stops moving and I've stopped screaming. And then Ixion yanks the gag off Rock and cuts the ropes binding his hands. He points at the smoking corpse beside him while Rock kneels on all fours, shaking. Clean it up! The room I'm staying in stinks of my own vomit, but I can't bring myself to open the window. Skipping dinner wasn't an option, which meant I had to watch Rock serve Ixion, had to let Rock serve me,
and the only thought that got me through it was that whatever hell this was for me, it was worse for Rock. We couldn't look at each other. Freda Basileon, who dined with us, asked more than once if I felt all right. I stop vomiting when there's a knock on the door.
My lord?
It's Rock, not meeting my eyes. Don't call me that. Rock pinches the bridge of his nose. He looks both ways down the corridor, then shakes his head slowly. His face is wiped, empty of emotion, as if he'd run out.
I think it's going to be easier for both of us, he says, if I do.
It's just a word. It's not a battle worth fighting. But I still feel like tearing this house down over our heads before I let it happen. Rock has been a comrade in arms, a loyal subordinate, a good friend. He was the one who once taught me how to do collections like a dragon lord, before he knew that I was one.
I was sent to prepare your room, Rock says. My lord.